طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. That is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. It is a difficult time for Palestinians, but then again, under occupation, it is always a difficult time for Palestinians. That is why we continue to marvel at the resiliency and passion for their land that seems to buoy them to continue their resistance against great odds. We certainly see that in Amr Zahr, our presenter this week, who gives voice to that resiliency and resistance of his people. Amr Zahr is an Arab-American comedian, speaker, writer, academic, and adjunct professor of law. He draws on his experiences growing up as a child of Palestinian immigrant parents, performing and lecturing on topics like politics, society, Islam, growing up Arab, and more. Here is Amr Zahr speaking with a Palestinian podcast producer, Salem Barame.
How you doing? How you holding up in these strange times?
Good. I'm just bored. I'm making a lot of food. I've experimented with a few kanafeh recipes. So, you know, I think things are going okay.
Nice, nice. Which one is your favorite so far?
Well, I mean, I only make naami. Only make kanafeh naami. And I'm experimenting with a dough. I don't want to give away my secrets. One day on social media, I'll let everybody know where I came, but we're almost there. I'm on experiment like number 10 right now. We're almost there.
All right, I can't wait to check out the recipe. But I saw this video of you introducing Bernie Sanders. Yeah. And as a Palestinian living in Palestine, it was quite inspiring to see. And you started by saying you're a Palestinian Arab American, a child of a Muslim immigrant and a Christian refugee, and you're supporting our Jewish brother, Amo Bernie, Habibi Bernie. What was it like? What was it like being Palestinian Arab American, you know, the child of a Muslim immigrant and a Christian refugee growing up in Pennsylvania?
It was different. I mean, look, my parents are both Palestinian. My dad is from Nazareth and Yaffa, and my mother is from Akka and Nazareth. And look, being the first, I was the only Arab kid in my school. We had no other Arab kids in the district, as far as I knew. Also, you know how our culture is. I mean, luckily Palestinians were fairly open-minded and secular when it comes to other Arab cultures. But still, you know, when you tell somebody that your dad is Christian and your mom is Muslim, you know, the first reaction you get from other Arabs or Palestinians is tabkif. So you know, that's always a conversation, right? But you know, being the only, you know, I was the only Arab kid in my school, so I would my experiences were different, right? You know, whether it's simple stuff like lunch, you know, I mean, you know, the white kids would show up with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and, you know, a bag of chips. And, you know, I'm showing up with like, I mean, have you ever had a metlube sandwich? Okay, like that's what my mom would give me. Like whatever was for dinner the night before magically became a sandwich at lunch the next day. One day it was metlube sandwich. Sometimes it's bamya sandwich, you know, sometimes fasulya sandwich, just whatever. It just turns into a sandwich. And then, you know, they all have like a little bag of Doritos or something, and I'm walking in there. My mom would give me bizip, you know, like I'm like, it's very hard to try to be cool at lunch, you know, when you're sitting there, but like, no, I like my lunch. You know, it's really good. So, I mean, you know, this is the world that I lived in. But then on the weekends, we would get together with all our Arab and Palestinian friends and families. And that's when, you know, culture was in our face. Mm. And so I never didn't know that I was Arab or Palestinian, but it was sort of like, you know, different roles, you know, during the week, mm. you try to be this nice American white kid, you play baseball, you try to fit in. And then on the weekends, we'd be at demonstrations and at meetings and, you know, all these kinds of things. So it was really interesting and fun. I look back at it now as a great experience, but of course it was a little confusing when I was a kid. And, you know, I wasn't immune from, you know, acts of racism. I mean, I ran for student president in the seventh grade. And look, by the seventh grade, I was 13 or 14. I really thought I was just like everybody else, fitting in. And I ran for student president, and I put up posters of my face all around the school. And the next day I came back to school and somebody had written on one of my posters, "Go home, terrorist." And wow. That was the first time I had ever felt that. Like, I knew I was different, mm-hmm. but I never knew how different I was or how I was different in a different way than other people were different. So that's when I started having a little bit more of a sort of political awakening as an Arab American. You know, I think every Arab American has two sort of like awakenings. One of them is a cultural awakening where you just know you're different, you know, you're, mm-hmm. and that happens at a very young age. You know, your parents might speak with an accent, you eat different food, maybe you worship differently, whatever. But that's a different kind of different than a political awakening, which for some Arabs, maybe it happens when they're kids, maybe it happens when they're teenagers, maybe it doesn't happen until they go to college, or till they get even older, when you realize that being Arab in America is not as simple as like hummus and tabbouleh. It is more like this nation has been fighting against our people for a very long time. They bomb us every day. We are seen as a threat. We are seen as not American enough. And all of that is like wrapped up in our experiences. And that's why it was so important that a presidential campaign like the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, a legitimate presidential campaign sort of brought us into the fold and said, you know, look, this is a community that is just like any other community and belongs to have a narrative in this process. So all of that rolled together sort of shows the importance of that.
Yeah, I listened to an interview where you ended it with, you know, you feel like as an Arab American, as a Palestinian American, you always have to preface with, "I love America," but you ended that interview, "It doesn't love me back."
Yeah.
And how did you feel like that affected you? I mean, as a child, as a teenager, did you feel like there was a tug of war on your identity? Did you want to be more American or more Palestinian or more Arab? Was there elements of not feeling enough, or do you feel like it made you able to understand things much more richly, much more in depth?
So I was 13 when the first Gulf War happened. That's when that story of somebody writing "terrorist" on my face happened. And it became very clear very quickly that as an Arab American, you had to sort of, you know, I don't want to say take a side, but sort of delineate your identities very clearly. And, you know, this is, it's hard to explain how you love a country. You do. You love we love America, right? I mean, it's where it's home in some way. Mm. You know, it's part of all the different layers of my identity. But, you know, I love a country that's bombing my homeland every day. Mm-hmm. And how do you express that? And how do you navigate that and deal with that? And so that is something that I think every Arab American deals with. And maybe especially in the last, well, unfortunately, they're always at war with us. But especially if you were a teenager, either during the first Gulf War. Look, I was 13 during the first Gulf War, and then I was like 25, 26 at the second Gulf War. And I was in graduate school. And that is a whole different experience, right? Where mm-hmm. again, and in the second Gulf War, the president of the United States literally told people, you're either with us or you're against us. So, you know, and 9/11 wrapped in between. It never stops, right? And then when you think things are starting to get better, then Trump comes around and reinforces a lot of these things. So, you know, we're always struggling to sort of prove our Americanness. I mean, I live here in Michigan, which is the largest Arab American population in the country, the most densely populated Arabs here in Dearborn, where I live. Mm-hmm. And on September 11th, everybody was in shock. On September 12th, every place in Michigan was sold out of American flags because every Arab had went out and bought an American flag to mm-hmm. put on their house to make sure everyone knew that they were, good, loving, patriotic Americans. This is the thing that we're always proving this. So we love America. It's clear. We come here. We do well. We raise our kids here. But yeah, at a certain point, we have to say America has to start to love us back too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How do you feel all those experiences shaped your comedy and becoming a comedian? I mean, you said you went to grad school. Was that, did you go to law school? Did you?
Yeah, I got a graduate degree in what they call Middle East and North African studies. And I have a law degree as well. And in my law degree, I concentrated a little bit on the Arab world, Islamic law, Islamic history, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Look, I'm a comedian. I'm an activist. Comedy is my tool. For some activists, poetry is their tool, or literature, or whatever. For me, comedy is my tool to tell the story of being Palestinian or being Arab American. And I just realized that, you know, it's something maybe that I'm good at and I can get a handle on. And when you make people laugh, they tend to listen to you a lot mm-hmm. more. And, but people always say to me sometimes, you know, I'm a comedian, and they'll say, you know, I never know if you're joking or you're being serious. And I say, you know, I'm a comedian. I use humor to tell the truth. I don't use humor to lie. I don't use humor to try to deceive. Mm. I'm always telling the truth. That's my job. I'm using humor to do that. And that's what, you know, that's the example I take from other good comedians who try to do that, you know, whether they're George Carlin or Dave Chappelle or Richard Pryor, who use humor to tell the truth. They're never trying to use humor to be deceiving. It's always using humor to tell the truth. And so
now I was just going to ask, what is it about humor that makes people listen?
Well, humor breaks you down, right? Humor, as a listener, brings down some of your safeguards, and then you're willing to sort of listen to what the person has to say. That's why every boring corporate meeting in the world starts with, you know, a guy trying to tell a joke, you know, or an icebreaker or something, you know, because everyone knows that that's what humor does. Now, a comedy show is a little bit more difficult because people are expecting you to be funny, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to be funny most of the time, not just in the beginning. But everyone knows that humor sort of lightens the mood, even if you're going to talk about something serious. And, the Palestinian case is not a light case. But, you know, I've learned that you can either start a conversation by talking about in a serious way of all the suffering and the, and look, there's people who do that and they're very effective at that. Or if you bring it with humor, you're much more likely to get an audience.
Mm. And when did that click for you? When did you realize that I want to, as a political activist, I want to use humor and comedy as my tool? I want to pursue this, make this a big part of my life.
Well, in law school, there was an Arab student group that was bringing a comedian to campus. And that comedian was coming by himself. It was Dean Obeidullah, who is a Palestinian-American comedian and a radio host. And he was sort of early on in doing his, this is like 2003, early on in doing his comedy and going around to different events and campuses. And the student group put out a call. They basically said, look, you know, does anybody want to sort of try something on stage? Because, you know, he's by himself. They just wanted to fill time on stage, basically. I said, you know, sure, I'll try. So I got up. I told a couple jokes about my dad and how he doesn't know how to answer voicemail and all that kind of stuff. And people laughed. I was really bad at it technically at that time, but people laughed. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. And I didn't use politics in my comedy. I was always a political activist, but I didn't use politics in my comedy until a little later when I started to become just more comfortable talking about anything, right? In the beginning, I was, and I encourage comedians not to do this now, but in the beginning, I was like safe. I would just talk about cultural stuff that wasn't necessarily political. And then it became more and more political a few years in, and you know, it became my profession and my life. I mean, I don't, you know, a lot of Arabs, they don't understand that like comedy is like my profession. It's my life. Yeah. You know? They say, what do you really do? I'm like, you know, this is what I really do. Sometimes I'll go to an event and they'll hand me a check. And while they're handing me the check, they say, so what do you really do? I'm like, I really do this. You just paid me money. This is what I do. So yeah.
No, my brother is an aspiring comic. He's obviously Palestinian, but in Germany. And so it took a minute for my father to understand why he wanted to do that, how that becomes a profession. So we had those conversations in our family.
I mean, look, I wouldn't necessarily, I encourage people to comedy is nice because there's usually, you can find a place to try things out, an open mic or something like that. But don't quit your day job right away, because I did shows for free for the first 2 or 3 years. And then, you know, maybe I got $50 or $100. The first time somebody paid me like $500, I was like, man, I'm going to be a millionaire from this. Now, you know, it's not 500, it's a little bit more, but it's not something that you like get a degree in and then you apply for a job and somebody gives you a paycheck. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
For instance, right now, you know, my income has completely stopped. I mean, this is part of it's, you're really being an entrepreneur if you want to do it. So you got to be ready for that kind of life. But you know, I've had about 20 or 25 gigs canceled because comedy is also the kind of art form that you can't do without an audience. Mm-hmm. You can't practice without an audience and you can't perform without an audience. So, you know, you really, when they said they were canceling gatherings, I was like, well, my whole life is gatherings. I mean, that's all I do is gatherings of 250 people or more. Mm-hmm. But you know, luckily, I think when this thing is over, probably comedians will be more in demand than anybody else, probably.
I would hope so. Yeah. Did you find it difficult as a Palestinian comic and then also a Palestinian comic who talks about very political subjects? What kind of backlash did you face, struggles, challenges?
Well, it's more of the losses of opportunity. So, you know, when you try one thing in America that you try to do is you try to get into comedy clubs or the comedy club circuit. And I've been told numerous times by comedy club managers that I'm too political. You know, I mean, they don't say that to black comedians or Latino comedians or white comedians who talk about Donald Trump. They happen to say it to the Palestinian comedian that talks about Israel. So there's that. But luckily, you know, our community and the supporters have been very supportive of me and what I do and allow me to turn it into a profession. So, you know, that is, I'm very lucky in that respect. But yes, there are opportunities that are closed, sort of like more mainstream opportunities that are closed to any Palestinian, frankly, who talks about, not just me, who talks about, and you know, that's a problem. But it's what I've chosen to do. I'm much more happy having the respect of my community, or when I walk around Palestine, people say, "Hey man, I watch you. Thanks for doing what you do," than whether or not I was able to get on like the Conan show or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that'll happen one day, but that's much less important to me than knowing that, you know, that I've been lucky enough that a lot of my fellow Palestinians have seen what I do and recognize it and see their voice somehow through that. That validation is much more important to me than sort of mainstream political validation in America.
Yeah. And as a person with a public platform, you know, especially in the US, I assume that you might be under attack quite often, Islamophobia, anti-Palestinianness, racist attacks. And there's usually attempts to delegitimize and silence. How do you deal with those? How do you take those on?
Well, I mean, it depends where it comes from. I mean, you know, if it comes from Twitter, you ignore it. I mean, you should read my Twitter feed. Woo. You have to have a thick skin, and you have to be able to ignore craziness, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you should always engage your followers in a serious way when they're being serious, but you have to ignore craziness, especially on social media. I mean, you know, that can get out of hand really quickly. Mm-hmm. There's so much bigger problems. But yes, I mean, I still get letters mailed. I mean, people are still taking the time to like mail letters to my house or my office telling me how anti-Semitic I am and all this kind of, that's the biggest attack, right? Mm-hmm. That we're anti-Semitic mm-hmm. or something like that, which I always found weird, especially when I was this last year. I mean, like, I must be the worst anti-Semite in the world. I'm trying to get the Jewish guy elected president of the United States. I mean, I must have missed the first day of anti-Semite school, which I don't know if there's an anti-Semite school or not. I've never been to one. But if there was one, I would imagine the first day would be like, hey, if a Jewish guy runs for president, don't support him. You know? So, I mean, the evidence is not there. But this is the world that we live in, and really that's the new attack. Well, it's not that new, but that's the attack of anytime you say anything critical about Israel, you're anti-Semitic, and that's not a real conversation starter. In fact, that's something that someone says to you in order to end the conversation mm-hmm. because they don't want to have a conversation about the. So that's why you got to kind of sort of ignore it.
Yeah, it's part of a global phenomenon where there's the cynical weaponization of the fight against anti-Semitism, and it's yeah. targeted at Palestinians and non-Palestinians who are critical of Israel. And you've seen a lot of, you know, anti-Palestinian laws all over the U.S. that are essentially criminalizing pro-Palestinian advocacy. You feel, I mean, it's interesting in the U.S. You have two forces. You have forces that represent, I think, Donald Trump, but then you also have progressive forces that represent Bernie. And where do you see things heading? Where do you see things heading on Palestine in the U.S.?
Well, I'll tell you first, what scares me the most is that things go back to the way they were before Trump.
Mm.
Okay, so when you have somebody like Joe Biden, who's arguing basically for the status quo and everything, including relations with Israel, that is more concerning to me than any sort of a result. I mean, to me, it's very clear that in this presidential year, the best result for Palestinians, if you care about Palestinian rights, the best result would have been a presidency by Bernie Sanders. The second best result, as far as I'm concerned right now, is a presidency by Donald Trump. The third best result is a presidency by Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that just take things back to the way they were. And the way they were is they were stealing our land and, you know, expanding settlements. Like nothing had really changed for the last 70 years. And Trump is like so crazy and so dumb. Like he doesn't have the guy doesn't actually have ideas. So he just does things to appease a certain portion of, you know, whether it's evangelicals or his son-in-law or Benjamin Netanyahu, I don't know. But a president without a strategy on on Palestine and Israel is way better than a president with a strategy to protect Israel at all costs. Yeah. I mean, you know, Trump, yes, I know that in Palestine things have been difficult because Trump canceled, you know, because of UNRWA and USAID and all that kind of stuff. Luckily, we're very resilient and we know how to make something out of nothing, and people have been resourceful and other countries have filled in the void. But look what Trump has done. Trump has like said to Israel, basically, do whatever you want. And whatever they want resulted in this like deal of the century party press conference they had at the White House that really showed everybody how ridiculous things are and really showed it. What was the deal of the century? The deal of the century basically showed everyone how things are in Palestine now. That map of the deal of the century was a map of the status quo. It's the map of how things are now. And so, you know, I said from the beginning, a few months after Trump was elected, I said, Trump and Netanyahu together, they are going to liberate Palestine by accident. You know, like just, you know, they're going to accidentally turn us into a one state and liberate us. I'm a one state believer. And I think that they're going to turn it into that if they keep going. In any case, that kind of like chaos and disorganization to me is better than returning back to a sort of well thought out, well formulated US foreign policy that had as its primary goal sustaining the occupation and protecting Israel at all costs, which meant sometimes saying to Israel, look, tamp down the extremism a little bit so that we can protect you politically. That's basically what Joe Biden is. Mm-hmm. And I'm not interested in any of that, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, I think the Trump-Netanyahu axis, I think, breaks the facade of the Oslo process, an era right. where they hide behind the process of negotiations where the U.S. is a mediator and, I mean, extremely biased mediator. And that allows, I think, what essentially has been the pursuit of the Greater Israel Project for a very long time. I'm from Jericho. I'm from the Jordan Valley. Yeah. And so when Netanyahu talked about annexing the Jordan Valley, you ask anybody in Jericho, how do you feel about being annexed? They'll tell you, oh, I thought I was already annexed.
Right.
And people don't realize that the settlements around Jericho weren't built a decade ago. Or built by the Likud and Netanyahu. They were built in the 70s by a labor party. Right. And this also ties into the differentiation between Netanyahu and Gantz and the blue and white. There's no left wing as traditionally understood in Israel. It's, you know, it's gradations of extremism.
The United States are basically, when the United States is conducting foreign policy as far as Israel is concerned, mm-hmm. like it has for the last 7 years, it's basically a form of, I guess, what some people would call like liberal Zionism, right? And the debate that happens in Israel is basically between a right and a left. And like you said, there's no real left, but what they call a right and a left. The right, which says, we don't want any Palestinians here, so let's find a way to get rid of them all. We want all the land, but let's find a way to get rid of them. So let's annex everything and kick them all into Jordan or Egypt because these Arabs have a disgusting culture and we can never live with them. And then you have the ones on the left, the liberal Zionists, who say, no, you know, let's be content with 80% of the land, maybe 90%. Let's give the Palestinians a small state somewhere so they all live with each other, because guess what? The Arabs have a disgusting culture and we can't live with them. I mean, both of them are based on this really racist idea that we, the people who have been here for thousands of years, somehow have this disgusting culture that they can't live with, although it kind of seems like they love it when hummus and falafel are the national snack of Israel. But okay, fine. We'll get into your messed up psychology another day. But everything is based on this deep, deep, deep racism. And we have to be careful about that. It's kind of like in America, right? You have the right wing of America, which let's just take as an example. They'll look at a Muslim woman who wears a hijab, and the right wing in America will say to her, you know, get out of here. That's disgusting. This country is not for you. Go back to where you came from. And the liberal wing of America will look at her and say, no, honey, It's okay. We accept you in this country. Please come live here with us. But you know, now that you live here, you don't have to wear that thing on your head anymore. This is a free country. You don't have to act like that anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this is what we deal with as Arabs or Muslims everywhere. And it's the same thing inside Israel. And so, yes, chaos that Trump is giving us with Netanyahu is probably the second best sort of like scenario behind a president like Bernie Sanders, who would actually look at Israel and say no every now and then, where Biden is going to return to the like, yeah, every now and then Israel doesn't like things that, or I don't like things that Israel does every now and then, but, you know, unbreakable bond, you know, we love each other, you know, the whole thing, just going back to the AIPAC talking points. That's what Biden's going
to
do.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, how did, you know, Palestinian Arab American end up a Bernie supporter? You know, you were saying you were supporting the Jewish guy for president. How did that end up happening? And are you reflective of the Arab American community and where they stand?
Well, yeah, it really started back in 2016, where the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign had an active sort of organizing arm that went into our communities, into Arab American communities, especially here in Michigan, to court us and talk to our organizers. And coupled with, you know, his viewpoints on Israel, which, by the way, have evolved. I mean, they've never gone as far as we'd like them to go. I mean, I'll be the first one to say that. But it is something that is revolutionary in the sense of American politics, and can be something that's pushed even more inside the movement. That progressive movement is pro-Palestine more than even the leaders of it are right now. But we can push them more on this. But it really started with a bargain, right? Those people came into our communities and said, we want your support. And no presidential campaign had really done that before in an aggressive way. And we said to them, look, we think we can deliver our support. We like Bernie, but he should say X, Y, and Z. And he did say X, Y, and Z, you know, said Palestinian rights are just as important as Israeli rights, that you can condition aid to Israel. And look, again, Bernie says things that I would never say, right? Bernie starts with talking about the security of Israel. I wouldn't talk like that. But in the sense of a presidential campaign, it is really revolutionary, and it is something that we can be optimistic about and work with. And in the world of politics, when you're campaigning, look, when you're doing electoral politics, you don't have an intellectual argument with yourself. You don't say, well, yes, this guy is going to be better than that guy, so I'll go vote for that guy. And you intellectually talk about the pros and cons of everybody. That's something you do later. When you're an activist and you're trying to get people to vote for somebody, you say, no, this is the guy. This guy's 100% better than the other guy, because you need people to be excited and go and vote, right? We made that bargain with Bernie, and Bernie lived up to his end. And then in 2016 and 2020, we lived up to our end. So the answer is, yes, am I reflective of the Arab American community? Here in Dearborn, where we have many, many voting precincts, which are almost fully Arab, okay? We had, first of all, in 2020, we had a 50% higher turnout than we had in 2016. And our community voted about 85 to 90% for Bernie over Joe Biden. So is pro-Bernie reflective of the Arab American community? Yes. It's very reflective of where our community is. Now the struggle is, right, if Biden is the nominee, how do you deal with that? You can't just, we've built up a lot of political power and capital now. You can't just give that away to Joe Biden for nothing. Mm-hmm. You have to get things back from him. And if you don't get it back from him, it's okay to say no. See, that's one of the lessons that Palestinians, I hope, have learned. One of the lessons we should have got out of Oslo is that it's okay to say no. It's okay to say, like, this doesn't live up to our standards. Mm-hmm. And you say no, and you walk away. And that might mean you don't get anything in that moment. Okay, fine. But, you know, you're in politics, people respect you a lot more when you live up to your, when you stand for your principles and you say no, and you're much more likely to get success later. You know, you can't live in this world of like, no, I need Joe Biden to like me now. Why? Who the hell is Joe Biden? He's a guy running for president. Okay, so there's going to be somebody else at a different point. Do you want to set up the standard where you're willing to settle for crumbs? No. So we have to be very, very careful about how we navigate these next few months with always understanding that it's okay to say no. So that's where it starts, right? No one is ever going to believe, no one is ever going to think that one state is possible in Palestine or that it is the best and most likely achievable goal, one democratic state, unless we Palestinians say it first. Right? We still haven't gotten to the point where we're saying it collectively. I think that we need to get to that point first. When you get to that point, if we get to that point in Palestine, it makes my job a lot easier, actually, in America as a Palestinian activist. It's easy for me to make the case of one democratic state where everybody has their rights, has nothing to do, than if I talk about two states, or if I'm forced to talk about two states, of like borders, and you give me that. American are not interested in that kind of conversation. They're not going to have that kind of conversation. And so they just sort of like ignore it. And then we end up in the situation that we're in. But we need to collectively among ourselves first say that, okay, Oslo's dead. Let's forget about doing postmortems on Oslo. Let's forget about blaming anybody for Oslo. Okay, fine, whatever. It happened. It's dead now. We now have to talk the same way that Nelson Mandela statue talked, which is, one state, all of our people united. Now, Israel will reject it right off the bat. Fine, who cares? Israel's rejected everything we've ever said. I'm not concerned about what my occupier thinks is a feasible solution. You know, that's not interesting to me at all. I'm also not concerned about what America thinks is a feasible solution. We have our ideals and our principles. We are one united people. As far as I know, the PLO still represents all Palestinians around the world. It doesn't represent only the Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And so if we're interested in that sort of unity, it starts with us. When we do it, when we lead the way, other countries will come along. Other countries, other movements, other peoples will say, yeah, that sounds right. That makes sense to me, right? What we're talking about with one state is basically an end of Jim Crow. I can argue that in America. I can't argue two states in America. It's very difficult. People don't understand. People check out. And so when we change the narrative among ourselves first, I think we will see that other people come along with us. And you can even get right wingers in America to say, yeah, you know what? A democratic state where everybody is treated the same. Okay, that's a principle I can understand and I can get along with, and you move. But, you know, Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress never said, look, we're worried about what Americans or American foreign policy or the American president is going to think about us when we make our ideals and principles. We can't worry about any of that kind of stuff. We have to do it first among ourselves, and then I think people will come along.
I agree with you 100%. I think there needs to be Palestinian unity. We need to rebuild a Palestinian political system that is representative, inclusive, and democratic. We need to figure out what we want and how we get there. I fully buy all that. But and so we change the narrative internally. Who are we selling this to? And if there isn't a progressive movement in the U.S. that is receptive to this narrative, that is able to potentially politically use leverage on Israel to be able to force a solution that ends, as you said, Jim Crow, essentially, then what are we doing?
No. You don't need that. Look, we have a lot more power than we know as Palestinians. We are party to this conflict in the eyes of the Americans. So if we say something in a united voice, that carries a lot of weight. You don't need a particular audience. You don't need to target progressives to believe in a one state and to get on board with you on one state. Bernie Sanders is a two-stater. Okay? I mean, I don't agree with him on that, but that was not what we were trying to achieve in the Bernie Sanders movement. So when you start talking about one state, people from all stripes can come into that. It's not about progressive or not progressive in America is about treating the Palestinians as human beings, right? We've never gotten to that point, unfortunately, in American politics. But progressive or not progressive is not about one state or two state, right? I mean, there's a lot of right-wingers in Israel who believe in one state. They just want us to get the hell out, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, one state that's based on democratic secular principles is something I can sell to a Trump voter in Alabama. I don't need that person to be progressive. It is a universal principle that I can sell to anybody. And if we say it, and that'll change the narrative monumentally, and that will make some people have to come along. So I don't agree with the premise that we need an audience of that, or at least that we need an audience that is of a particular political leaning. I think the one democratic state sort of can be something, at least in America, that appeals to everybody. If there's one thing all Americans basically agree on now, is that, you know, a democratic country where people have rights that are regardless of like their skin color or their religion, that's something like, you know, 90% of Americans agree on. And so I can sell that easy. I don't need somebody to be a progressive to listen to that.
Sure, sure. No, for me, I've seen the polling on Palestine and Israel and the way it's kind of evolved over the last couple of years, where it's become a wedge issue between the two parties. And I think if you're, politics is tribal. And so if you're part of the Republican tribe, you're very likely to accept everything that's pro-Israeli and not really internalize anything that might be pro-human rights or pro-Palestinian or pro-values or pro-democracy. That's not your starting point. And conversely with the Democratic Party, I think there is that now almost acceptance of the humanization of the Palestinian people. So for me, I do see it might be a tougher sell in a very polarized political world where, for, you know, half of the country might not even see us as human beings.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that, and again, look, that half of the country that doesn't see you as human beings now is in the framework of a, look, I bet you that half, most of them already think, and I live in America, and you lived here for a while too, most Americans already think that there's a country called Palestine, there's a country called Israel, and they're fighting each other. And these ones that are fighting the Palestinians, they are, you know, Arabs and Muslims, and they're terrorists. And why don't they just stop? If they just stopped fighting, everything would be okay. We've never expressed the situation as one of, especially since 1993, and now, you know, most people just think in that way. We've never expressed the situation in terms of occupation, dispossession, land theft. We don't talk about it in those terms anymore because we've been talking in terms of statehood for a long time, okay? And those things people don't understand. So I'm not surprised that a lot of people just say, well, what the hell are these people fighting about? You know, why don't they just go home and stop fighting? Well, no, here's the problem. There is no home to go to, right? There's no system to try to build. We're living under constant threat and occupation. Most Americans don't even know that. And that's our fault in some way that we haven't led with that. That the truth is we had much more success educating people about the Palestinian cause before Oslo than after Oslo, right? And before Oslo, people understood more, you know, better what actually was going on. After Oslo, and frankly, a lot of it's our fault. When I walk around Ramallah and I see cars from the government and buildings, well, from the government, I mean, it's not even a real government, that have State of Palestine and Dolat Palestine written ever, I'm like, what are you guys doing? I mean, we don't have these things. You know, it's delusional. I mean, if I invited you, if I said, Salim, I want to invite you to my kid's birthday party, you would say, great, when is it? I say, on Saturday. You would say, great, how old is he going to be? I say, well, you know, he's actually not born yet, but we're having a birthday party, and I would like you to come and bring a gift. You might smile at me, and you might say, okay, I'll be there Saturday, and then you're going to go tell all your friends how crazy I am, okay? It doesn't make any sense. And so it takes us away from what the real narrative is, which is they stole our land. They're literally still living in my grandmother's house. That's a thing. That happened. And that's really basically the world that we're living in today. Nothing has really changed much from then. They think that we are a people not worthy of political rights like anybody else. And that's when you can make the parallels to Jim Crow America and apartheid South Africa. But as long as you talk about, hey, let's have negotiations with these people and decide where the borders are going to be, nobody thinks of us in terms of a civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So we have to change that narrative first among ourselves. Then we can let people understand this is a civil rights movement. But it's our fault as long as we are talking about states and negotiations and, you know, no one understands that. They start to think that we're already a country. We're telling them that we are.
One thing I wanted to ask you is the majority of Palestinians live outside Palestine. Refugees live in exile and diaspora. How common are those views that, you know, you just articulated and that we've been discussing amongst Palestinians that live abroad
or don't? Well, I think the one state or talking about one state I found is much more popular outside of Palestine than it is. More prevalent outside of Palestine than it is in Palestine. Privately, when you have conversations with people inside Palestine and you say, hey, are you down with one democratic state for everybody? Like, most of the time I get the answer is yes, most of the time. But you really need leadership and people to express it in that way. I mean, I think if you express, look, the notion of the other side just leaving and getting the hell out, that's a notion that's much more prevalent on the Israeli side than it is on our side. Mm-hmm. I think we've sort of come to this thing like, okay, fine, these people are going to be here. Some of them might leave eventually, but okay, fine, they're going to be here. And we're going to live with them. We're going to have to find a way to live with them. That's what Oslo was all about. Mm-hmm. But we were the ones that were prepared to like live with them under Oslo. They're the ones that killed their leader, not us. We welcomed our leader with a parade. Now, yeah, that was a mistake. We shouldn't have done all that. But we welcomed our leader with a parade. They killed their leader. So who are the ones that are ready to live with the other person? Mm-hmm. So we've kind of come to that, okay? And I think that one state is very popular among our people. If you told the Palestinian who lives in Ramallah, your new reality is you can go to Haifa whenever you want. That means work, social, whatever. I mean, Palestine is not that big of a country. If you start telling people you can move freely in all of your land, you can marry freely, you can commerce freely, all that kind of stuff, that's a very, very popular idea because we do all understand that we are one people. Right? We shouldn't buy into the Israeli thing that the Palestinians who live in Israel are one group, the Palestinians who live in the West Bank are another group, the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem, Gaza, diaspora, like five or six different classes of Palestinians. No, we're one people.
No, I totally agree with you.
It starts with us. That's my point. We have to start with us.
I hear you. I guess the question is the one state conversation prevalent abroad in the diaspora?
Oh yeah. In America, it's all what most people talk about. Mm. I mean, the PLO and the PA are not that popular in America among Palestinians. They can't have an event somewhere and, you know, I mean, they used to do it with the PLO mission and they would have events and people would show up, but not with enthusiasm, not with pride. Even though, look, the PLO, we want to like the PLO. We do. The PLO is our people, and I believe very strongly in that, okay? We're unified. I love every Palestinian. But here's the thing. The way you guys have been doing stuff, it hasn't worked. So let's try this other way, right? It's the same thing we've been told the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders. You guys want to put up these centrist moderate candidates? Well, guess what? Al Gore, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, twice. They lose. They don't win. But they don't inspire.
I want to ask you the why, Ahmed. Why do people tend to have the conversation around one state more? Why do they feel a certain disconnect from the PLO? I think it's important to highlight to people why these issues have come to be.
Well, because it's sort of cyclical, right? We started out with a national liberation strategy of all the land is our land, right? And that sort of like whittled away until we got to Oslo. And it didn't whittle away because of people changed because, okay, maybe you started to have some realists came into the scene and said, okay, let's try to get what we can. It turns out that when you're dealing with an occupier who thinks that you're not actually a person, that that strategy doesn't work. Okay, and Edward Said and Mahmoud Darwish and a lot of other people said that at the time. But it doesn't work. Okay, fine. Now we are in a completely post-Oslo world, and that's probably much more prevalent in the diaspora than it is inside of Palestine. Mm-hmm. So in the diaspora, people are not even, no one even talks about when's the next meeting with the Israeli negotiator. Like, no one even thinks about that. The not Oslo honeymoon was much shorter.
Not even
well, no,
here.
Back home, people still in power. Think about that. But let's when I talk about people in power in America, in other words, any Palestinian political activist, any Palestinian leaders of Palestinian groups here in America, no one talks about two states, Oslo, negotiations. That doesn't even come out of anyone's mouth, okay? Here, it's all about rights and Palestinians being treated equally. And then that usually transforms very quickly into a one-state solution. We're at the point now, by the way, where as Palestinian activists, even if a Democratic politician comes to us and says, hey, I want your support on a resolution in Congress that reinforces American support for a two-state solution, we say, we're not really that interested in that. What mm-hmm. else does it say? Does it talk about the humanitarian situation in Gaza? Okay. Does it talk about lifting the blockade? Okay. But reiterations of American policy around Oslo are not something that we're interested in anymore. We don't even put any political capital into it. You have mm-hmm. to say other stuff too in order to get us interested in it. So we're past that mm-hmm. anymore. Probably a little bit more than in Palestine, but in Palestine, I see people are getting way past that too. It's really just like the elite at the top who find their power in staying with the Oslo process who are still interested in talking in those ways.
No, that's spot on. Thank you. I think it was important for people to understand why and why it's growing and why people are coming to believe it and talk about it and that in fact it represents a lot of Palestinians all over the world.
Look, I'm a Palestinian who believes in the unity of all Palestinians. All Palestinians are my brothers and sisters first. And so when I look at the PA and the PLO, I think they've made a lot of mistakes, okay? But they're not our enemy. We have a real enemy, okay? I'm willing to accept that everything the PA and the PLO did with Oslo was done with good intentions, that they really thought it was the best idea. Fine. We've now learned that it's not. It was a disaster. It was a bad decision. It's time to move on. And we have to move on with the recognition that we as Palestinians are all in this together and that we all have to be unified and we have to see each other as brothers and sisters. We don't have the luxury of treating each other as enemies because we have a real, actual enemy who is killing us every day and taking our land every day. So we need to get past any, we can have internal political divisions, that's fine, but we don't have internal enemies. That sort of thinking cannot exist.
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم